In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with doctor, coach, and lifter Jordan Feigenbaum from Barbell Medicine. Jordan and I speak about whether CrossFit is safe, when to change lifting technique to prevent injuries, tips for healthy and fit travel, and more. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Jordan, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Jordan. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, doctor, coach, and lifter. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's my absolute pleasure to speak with you. You are a coach and co-owner, I believe, of Barbell Medicine. Is that correct?
Yep, I started this 2012 and I'm the owner and creator of Barbell Medicine.
Amazing. I have to say, I absolutely love the name of it. And I would love to hear just a little bit about your history, just how you got into it all, your 15 years of coaching or more, and what inspired you to create Barbell Medicine?
Sure. Yeah. I started out as a trainer, coach, just a personal interest and in kind of what I liked doing. And then when I went to medical school, I was probably a coach and trainer, and then ended up doing some education within a personal training company, just teaching other coaches how to train folks. And then I got into medical school, and it was interesting because every class you would take, especially during the first two preclinical years in lecture, you would get this sort of lifestyle is really important. People should exercise and eat a health promoting dietary pattern, but there was never any sort of education on, okay, well, what does that actually mean? So just, fund of knowledge type stuff. And then further, how do you communicate that effectively to patients, whether it's behavior change strategies, motivational interviewing, or whatever. And I was like, well, I've been doing this for a long time, prior to medical school. Maybe I should, do some work to try to bridge the gap. And I just thought it was a little pet project, kind of like, oh, I'll write some stuff, publish it on the internet, see what happens, just as more catharsis than anything else. Like, oh, I'll feel good about doing it. Like I felt like I needed to do it, and it turned into a whole business. So yeah, I met Dr. Baraki in medical school and his wife, and we've been working together ever since, and expanded the team. And yeah, we've been all over the globe teaching this stuff, and we're sort of big on the internet, I guess. But it's been fun. I really, really have enjoyed the process now for just over 10 years with Barbell Medicine.
Amazing. Well, I do have several questions, and later I want to get into your travels and your seminars and so on as well, because I am a fellow travel lover, and I do think you can share some wonderful strategies for how to navigate travels and staying sharp mentally and physically as well throughout. But before we get into that, you are still to this day a very ambitious power lifter, I believe, and you are holding one of the top 20 totals of all time. So how did you get into the sport and competing per se?
Yeah, no, it's kind of like my origin story for just even getting involved in lifting. I raced motorcycles originally. That was kind of my sport of choice. If you call it a sport, I don't know. There's some to do about whether or not it's a sport. I think it is. But yeah, that's for another podcast. And I dislocated my hip and I couldn't walk. So I dislocated my left hip. I couldn't walk for about 3 months. I was 18 at the time. And when I finally was cleared to start moving around, I had a limp. And the physical therapist that came to my house, she was like, you need to do some strength training so you can walk around normally. And so that's the first time I ever lifted weights, really. And I really enjoyed it. I like the idea of going to the gym, having a set plan and kind of going through it. And at that time, you think back, that's mid 2000s, early 2000s. There's nothing on the internet really at that time. You can't search a strength training program. That didn't exist. There was a handful of resources. So yeah, that's how I got into lifting weights. And I really just enjoyed the process of getting stronger, and subsequently powerlifting I got introduced to that after I graduated college, and that was right when raw powerlifting kind of took off. Now, for your listeners, if you're not familiar, powerlifting prior to maybe 2010, 2012, certainly, was always just you'd wear a squat suit. This is supportive equipment, helps you lift more weight. There was no such thing as raw powerlifting, at least not a separate division. And in 2012, it became a pretty big thing. And so that's how I got my start. And I've been able to put up some pretty, I don't know, some would call them impressive numbers. They're fine for me. It's me against me. That's kind of how I view it. But certainly now that the sport is growing, and again, you could argue whether or not powerlifting is a sport. Again, another podcast. But I have become less strong comparatively because we have a larger sample size now. You know, when I first started lifting, there was maybe a few thousand lifters worldwide that were actively competing at any given time. And now there's, you know, hundreds of thousands. So yeah, as that athlete pool has grown, people have gotten much stronger. And I, as an aging individual, have not gotten as strong comparatively, but I still, my last meet was last October, and I've set all-time PRs on all my three lifts. So look, if somebody's impressed with the mid 300 or mid 700 pound deadlift, then great. I'm happy to impress them, but otherwise it's just for me.
Well, us against ourselves, that's always the best. And isn't it interesting how just simply the sample pool, as you called it, that can change things and numbers. I come more from like a CrossFit type background. And when I did CrossFit, so I haven't done CrossFit since 2018 due to injuries. But when I got into CrossFit in 2014, it was a much smaller sample pool as well. And people that were really good back then, nowadays, they would probably not even go to regionals or anything like that. And mm-hmm. that brings me to one of the questions I had for you. One thing I saw on one of your content pieces just recently was a question posed, is CrossFit safe? So some of our listeners, not all, but a few of our listeners have dabbled in CrossFit, have had some experience with CrossFit, perhaps do a little bit of CrossFit still. What is CrossFit safe?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think, you know, most people who have been involved in the strength training, or we'll just call it like physical conditioning sort of scene for a while, they may have been put off by CrossFit initially, especially if they weren't an early adopter. You know, they might have seen it more as a nuisance, or, you know, people doing unconventional things at the time in the gym. And so whatever your opinions are about CrossFit, we can divorce those from the actual sort of evidence or analysis of whether or not it is a unique, it is uniquely dangerous from an injury risk standpoint with respect to other forms of physical activity, or compared to other forms of physical activity. And when you look at it through that lens, you just take any sort of personal preference or bias aside, and you just say, well, is CrossFit more dangerous than like powerlifting, for example, or recreational powerlifting, those who don't go to a powerlifting meet, or Olympic weightlifting, just on its own sort of pure sort of Olympic weightlifting programming, or even bodybuilding, you know? And you look at injury rates, and there's some squish or fuzziness around that, because it's hard to actually define what an injury is and what an injury isn't, you know? So for example, when you look at like pediatric injury rates during resistance training, one of the reports is, oh yeah, this kid had a quad pain in the middle of his quad for 30 seconds, and that was recorded as an injury. And you're like, well, that may not count. But anyway, so that's just an example. But when you look at the injury rates between CrossFit compared to other forms of physical activity, particularly resistance training based physical activity, they're about the same. And certainly if there was like this really high risk that was reliable across, you know, all different types of CrossFit, how it's being practiced in the wild, you'd expect to see that, because it's not that it hasn't been investigated. It has been, you know, dozens of times. And I suspect that until a good amount of data comes out saying otherwise, like, wow, CrossFit is uniquely injurious or uniquely risky on this other thing, you kind of just have to say it's probably about the same. Certainly not a massive increase in injury risk, which most people probably assume. So that's just wrong, and at least based on current evidence. And then further, what are the risks of CrossFit compared to insufficient activity? Meaning that if CrossFit is somebody's personal like fitness kink, they love that. And that's their, you know, they like the community aspect, they like the movements, they like pushing themselves in that regard. Well, let's compare the injury risks and health trajectory of that compared to insufficient physical activity that they would otherwise have a difficult time adhering to something else. And I think on balance, CrossFit's been net beneficial for those folks and other things like the equipment industry. It's easier to get fitness equipment. When you're traveling, if we go into that, it's easy to find a CrossFit gym to either drop into or even use for open gym. And maybe even women in strength sports in particular, probably they've all been positively affected by CrossFit. You know, I got a lot of pushback on that from people who I think just assume like, well, no, look at the movements. The movements are, some of them are done at high velocity. Some of them are done for high repetition. Some of them are done under a fatigued state. There certainly has to be more injury risk. We're just not catching it. I'm like, that's a fine hypothesis, but then you have to test it. And so if you're just generating a hypothesis and it currently hasn't been tested, then that's fine. You could say, I think that CrossFit is more risky. I just can't prove it yet. So I'm going to temper my opinion. That's a reasonable take. I kind of take the other side that, hey, look, until proven otherwise, I assume that it's about the same. And the existing evidence does support that. The average injury rates for all forms of resistance training is about 2 to 4 injuries per 1,000 participation hours, which is just a little more than like recreational cycling. So, and CrossFit falls right within that range. And on balance, I think the benefits of exercise, even if it's CrossFit that some people would say is coached wrong or improperly or whatever, they don't seem to be excessive risks. The only thing I will note that's unique about CrossFit is the risk of rhabdomyolysis. That's a sort of excess muscle breakdown. It does seem to be a unique sort of condition that CrossFit tends to have a higher rate of compared to bodybuilding, powerlifting, Olympic weightlifting, strongman training, et cetera. But again, it's so rare relative to the amount of people and the amount of hours that people have spent exercising that despite being true that there's a higher risk of rhabdomyolysis with CrossFit, it's still relatively low risk overall. And so I don't get too worked up about that other than noting that's a possibility if CrossFit's done too heavy or too enthusiastically compared for someone's fitness level, which again is not unique to CrossFit. It just seems to be maybe for time or in a competitive setting, maybe there's a higher risk there, but overall still pretty low risk.
Yeah, some really great points. And as far as I'm aware, rhabdo is mostly also associated with a high amount or high volume of eccentric movement. So that's probably like in the kipping movement or in the, even if you see the GHD sit-ups, like from that downward movement, et cetera, that's how I have heard of rhabdo occurring anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, not very many times at all.
No. Yeah. I mean, there are case reports certainly on this, of CrossFit athletes or people in like sort of competitive settings that you would call CrossFit getting rhabdomyolysis. And yes, like you mentioned, long eccentric, particularly with novel movements, particularly in a competitive setting, plus or minus some heat related stress. So if it's hot outside or dehydration is a concern, sure, all of those things can predispose to rhabdomyolysis, but you can get it from like just squats. Also, that happened at a college campus here in the United States, not more than a few years ago. There was like a off-season workout and they had their football team do a bunch of squats. I believe it was 10 sets of 10. So some German volume training and a number of them got rhabdomyolysis. Now it wasn't CrossFit, but people just chastised the strength and conditioning coach like, hey, that was not appropriate for this group of people, which is kind of the risk of using a non sort of scaled program for folks. And CrossFit does a reasonable job of that. Again, if there was this big smoking gun behind CrossFit, you would expect to see, wow, the injury rates are so much higher. But we just don't see that. So.
Yeah, and I can absolutely personally 100% agree that if it was not for CrossFit, I don't know how I would have found my way to strength training per se. So mm-hmm. for me, exactly, it was that entry point. And I think for many other women that I know as well. But yeah, speaking of injuries, I saw that a while ago you had an injury with your adductors. Is that correct? I would love to hear how you A, trained around that and B, just in general recommendations for training around injury. Is that something we should be doing?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. This goes back to November of 21. I was preparing for a meet and I got COVID like 3 weeks out from a meet and was not feeling awesome, but I tested negative. I'd prepared for this meet for a long time. So I figured, well, I could probably go to the meet and be fine. I'll just be a little conservative. And my first squat attempt, I believe, was 600 pounds. That went fine. I went up to 630 or something like that, 285 kilos, 290 kilos. I forget offhand. And I actually got called on depth. Now, that's never really happened to me before, but I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm just a little detrained. So I'll sink this third one. I'll go real deep. And when I got to the bottom, I felt a pop, immediate pain running down my right leg. Yeah, luckily the spotters were there. I didn't, crash or anything like that. They just helped me back up, racked it, and instantly my right leg is swollen, bruised. It was pretty gnarly. I had a problem doing pretty much everything. I mean, anything from getting out of bed to walking around without a limp to any of the exercises that I would normally do. So regular squat, bench press, even like laying down on the bench was quite painful. I figured out ways that I could do the movements, like versions of the movement. So for example, on a squat, I couldn't squat below parallel, even with body weight alone, but I could do an assisted squat. So we had a belt squat machine, for example. So I could squat while holding onto the handles and going down to just above parallel. That was fine. I could squat a bar on my back to above parallel to pins with the tempo component. So 3 seconds down, 3 seconds up. That was fine. I could deadlift from blocks where the bar was just above knee level, again with the tempo. Ultimately, I was trying to reduce the sort of like velocity at which I was moving with because I could tolerate that movement a little bit better. So anyway, that's basically I found an entry point. And that's my general kind of rule of thumb. With whatever sort of musculoskeletal injury that you have, finding an entry point that is as close to the movement or activity that you want to do or would otherwise be restriction-free from doing, do that, and that's where you start. And then you gradually kind of work back towards this unrestricted movement pattern. And so it was probably, I don't know, 10 weeks all in before I was back to doing regular deadlifts and squats. And yeah, it wasn't a huge deal overall. It was just kind of frustrating, I guess, more than it. That was the biggest, the mental sort of thing. I was like, wow, prior to being sick and certainly prior to having this adductor tear, I was lift what I felt like I was lifting the world. I felt real strong and everything else. And then it's kind of dang, a setback. But, 10 weeks was the price I had to pay and was back to it. But overall, for injury stuff, finding the entry point, that's probably the biggest thing that people mess up. They don't go back far enough. It's like they don't regress the movement far enough to actually be mostly symptom free or at a tolerable level of discomfort. The second biggest mistake people don't do is they don't take enough weight off the bar or weight off the machine or whatever. And so even if the movement itself is sort of tolerable at a lower load, they'll want to load it too heavy and still remain sort of sensitive to that movement pattern, which the longer that goes on, it's tough to break. Just think about if every time that you deadlifted, you had excruciating, hamstring pain, hip pain, low back pain, or whatever. Man, that's going to follow you around psychologically for quite a while. And so making sure to take enough weight off the bar is the kind of second biggest thing that I would advise. And the third thing is that if you can identify elements of your programming that may have predisposed you to injury, whether it was flying too close to the sun, and that's just a metaphor for loading things too heavy, too close to failure, too often. Certainly a time and a place for that, but probably not ad nauseum, like on end for weeks and weeks and weeks. That's a problem. Reduced exercise variation, that's a problem. And then overall doing too much for what your current fitness levels are. Those are the things that I would be looking at in somebody's programming to try to see, like, is there something that when we do get back to this unrestricted level of training, now we're probably at a little lower level of fitness. We tried our best to maintain and improve fitness during the rehab period, but we're probably still a little detrained compared to where we were. Well, let's not jump back into that program immediately. Maybe let's do this more intelligently if there's something that we can identify. Sometimes it's just bad luck. And so you might not find anything, but yeah, kind of like an analysis of what happened, that's probably useful.
Yeah, I think several points. I'm grateful that nowadays we know that just staying mobile and staying active in one way, shape, or form is usually more beneficial than just saying, oh, I'm
Oh,
going to
yeah.
completely rest and stop for weeks or even months. Even just from the mental perspective of getting back into training and all the other muscles atrophying because of that as well. And then the second interesting thing I think you mentioned is the mental component, because I actually just read a paper on chronic pain and how often the mental aspect really plays into that, where yes, initially we have that chronic or we have pain, we have an injury, but after a while we just simply start anticipating that, or and then also going into movements to avoid that pain, and then developing poor patterns in the long term because we might be avoiding or not pushing through our right leg as much anymore as through our left leg. And I don't know if that was something that you were really aware of also, that you would not go into any negative movement patterns.
Yeah, I mean, the expectation around, like, oh, I'm going to feel pain or I expect to feel pain during this movement. I mean, you take somebody with low back pain that's been bothering them for years and years and years, right? And then you ask them to do a deadlift. They've never deadlifted before. And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. I can't bend over like that. I certainly can't, expose my spine to that sort of loading. They had this sort of expectation that it's going to cause pain. And so what you're trying to do then is violate that expectation. It may be something as simple as like hinging body weight only close to a wall. So they bend over a little bit and oh, wow, you tolerated that. And then overplaying that, hey, you did great. Amazing job. Maybe the next time they end up doing something like that is with a light kettlebell or dumbbell. So it's, like a goblet sort of deadlift or something like that. And then maybe it's a barbell, from a high box or something like that. So expectation violation, a big, big thing. And not, as you said, sort of learning or anticipating that sort of pain experience. That's thing one. And then two, like you mentioned, this sort of maybe we'll call them faulty movement patterns or compensatory movement patterns. Yeah. You see that all the time, especially in, unfortunately, I'm going to out my own sort of cohort here in powerlifters. If we get a shoulder injury or a hamstring injury, we can find ways to sort of train around it. We'll just move a little slower or change the grip or the stance a little bit, which can be useful in the short term, especially if you have like a meet coming up or it's important that you just keep training above all else. But long term, you sort of lose this sort of range of physical sort of capacity. Like if you can't tolerate a wider grip bench press, well, that might be okay for a couple weeks. You go to a meet, do your thing, but you still want to have access to that later on. Or maybe you lose the ability to squat with the bar in a certain position on your back because you have some upper limb sensitivity. And you just want the full complement of range of motion across your joints to basically do whatever it is you want and certainly whatever it is you need to do. And so kind of these compensatory things should be addressed in a systematic fashion. You don't want people to do that for too long. For me with the adductor, my biggest thing was velocity. And so, for example, I got back to deadlifting 250 kilos, 550 pounds for sets of eight, but they were very slow, not because I was weak per se, but because I was unwilling to sort of go fast because I was afraid that my adductor was going to hurt. And so it was funny. The sets looked like every rep was RP9, really close to failure, but I just kept doing them. I was kind of unintentionally or unconsciously like going slower. And so I actually had to program in some more ballistic work where I was doing some jumps. And I started this, I remember doing this, I felt so stupid. I was like a box that was like 6 inches and I would do a depth jump, just dropping down and then jumping back up. And then eventually I was doing high speed deadlifts, high speed belt squats, just to get comfortable moving quickly. And eventually I was desensitized to kind of just going and, recruiting all of those motor units and those muscle fibers to create force. And so again, I just kind of unlearned that compensatory habit and movement pattern that I had. Again, I didn't want to go there, but that's just where my body kind of figured out how to do the task I was asking of it at the time.
Really interesting. And yeah, sounds like obviously it was a successful strategy. And I guess speaking of speed or velocity also, another interesting piece of your content that I recently saw was cardio in regards to that, because as someone who has been in pursuit of maximal strength for many, many years, is that something where you say, yes, powerlifters or people pursuing strength should still be doing cardio, yes or no? Or even pursuit of hypertrophy.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, if we back up and we think about like long-term, physical development, in order to maximize hypertrophy, in order to maximize strength, you're going to have to train for a long period of time. Right. And so that usually starts for most people who end up being high level performers. It usually starts in their teens or 20s. That's just when you start and you end up, reaching a peak late 20s, early 30s. And then from there, you're hoping for small gains into your fifth and sixth decades. And then, whatever happens after that, there's some luck involved there, but certainly how often you train. But the point is, it's over a long period of time. And you want to be strong for life. You want to maintain muscle mass or improve it for as long as you can, and then maintain it as long as you can as well. You're going to need to be alive and in good health for that to happen. And so certainly some baseline level of cardiorespiratory fitness is necessary to do so. And for most individuals, resistance training alone will not get them there. So that's thing one. So just from a longevity standpoint, even longevity in training, you're going to need some sort of baseline level of cardiorespiratory fitness that you're probably not going to get. Most people are not going to get from resistance training. In fact, the current evidence suggests that as far as cardiorespiratory fitness goes, You can measure that with VO2 max and a number of other tests, but it only goes up from resistance training if you were very, very detrained before, meaning that your VO2 max was almost pathologically low before, and then you basically do anything, in this case, resistance training, it'll go up a little bit, but not to the level you need, that sort of minimum level that you would need for maybe for a health trajectory that would otherwise be limited by cardiorespiratory fitness. So my general recommendation is that folks at least complete, all folks at least complete the minimum physical activity guidelines recommended amount of cardiorespiratory fitness, which is about 2.5 hours per week of moderate intensity conditioning. So that's stuff where your heart rate's somewhere between like 60 and 80% of your max heart rate. Most days of the week should be active, so 20 to 30 minutes a day. That's sort of where I have most of my strength athletes sort of live for most of their competition prep. These are people that are going to meets and trying to, you know, set the world on fire with strength. And sure, as we get closer to a meet, 3 weeks out, 2 weeks out, that stuff gets cut way, way down. You know, the week of the meet, they might be doing only two sessions a week, but that's just a short period of time. The majority of the training year, they're doing a significant amount of conditioning work. If you're not a strength athlete, like full on, you get paid for this, it's the thing that, you know, gets you up in the morning to go lift weights, for example, I would favor more cardiorespiratory fitness training, because we know that there seems to be this dose dependent relationship between cardiorespiratory fitness and improvements in health. That means reduced mortality from cardiovascular disease, reduced mortality from cancer related diseases. In fact, all cause mortality goes down in a dose dependent relationship with cardiorespiratory fitness. And that just means the more cardiorespiratory fitness that you have, the less chance you have of dying from all causes, and specifically cardiovascular disease and cancer related mortality. So I think, you know, if there's any sort of misappropriation of training resources that occurs in strength sports or in, you know, physique minded individuals or direct individuals, it's not doing cardio. And to me, it's a weird flex. They're like, oh, I just don't do any conditioning unless I'm trying to lose weight, for example, or if it's just an endurance block. And I'm like, I don't know that that's great for longevity. In fact, I would advise against that. Are you likely to have your highest level of endurance, you know, max endurance capacity and max level of strength at the same time? Probably not. But the majority of folks are not like top level strength athletes or top level endurance athletes. And so somewhere in the middle is probably more appropriate for folks. And if I had to bias my sort of programming recommendations for general health, it would probably be spending more total time doing cardiorespiratory fitness training and less total time doing resistance training. That's for people who are already, you know, involved in exercise. Unfortunately, most people don't exercise. And those who do exercise, most of them don't lift weights. And so from a public recommendation standpoint, I want to get more people to lift weights. But the people listening to your podcast, the people listening to my podcast, they're like, I lift weights all the time. You're telling me I should do cardio too? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Yes. Do both. Make sure you're doing enough of both. And then, go from there based on your preferences.
Awesome. Well, and I would love to dig into that even more. So you mentioned a person, I assume you also work with quite a few Gen Pop people. And so therefore someone, let's just say they come to you and they say, I want to be strong, I want to look great, and I want to have good cardiovascular fitness, of course, that unicorn sort of goal. But how would you approach their periodization, whether that pertains to training and or nutrition or both, over the course of a year or even three or whatever, in order to get the benefits of all of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, people conflate sort of programming and periodization as like analogous terms. And the way I think about it is the program is effectively the details of your training. So exercise selection, sets, reps, rest periods, modalities, and so on. And then periodization is how that changes over time in general to elicit a set of physical adaptations, fitness adaptations in this case. So we want somebody to be stronger, we want them to gain muscle mass, we want to improve cardiorespiratory fitness. And the way I take that particular approach is I tend to favor what's called a concurrent approach, meaning that rather than having like a hypertrophy block and then a strength block and then a power block and then an endurance block, we're generally training all of these things at the same time, perhaps with some sort of shift in priority based on the person's preferences and their response. Meaning that if somebody just goes off to the races with, you know, with respect to their strength improving and they gain more muscle mass with, you know, what would be classically considered a higher rep range than pure strength work. So instead of working in that 1 to 5, 1 to 6 rep range, they tend to respond really well to 4 to 8, 4 to 5 to 10. Fine. I'm going to pick that up post hoc, like after the sort of initial sort of programming recommendation. And so the next sort of mesocycle or training plan that they'll run for a continuous period of time is going to look a little different. But I don't do, you know, hey, we're going to focus just on size or just on strength, just on power, just on endurance. We're training all of that stuff at the same time with, again, some slight reallocation of resources based on the person's preferences and response. So a typical session that I would program would be, okay, we're going to movement of the day, and we're favoring strength for that particular movement. So maybe multiple sets of 4 to 6 reps. Great. If it's a full body workout, the next exercise might be an upper body type of press. And again, if since it's not the priority movement for the day, maybe that's biasing more size, if you will, although we do expect people to gain strength within that rep range and the movement that they're training. So maybe that's, you know, 6 to 10 reps or 8 to 12 reps. And then that might be the same for a third exercise. That's a hinge on something. It's an RDL, what done with the dumbbells or done with the barbell. And that's your full body sort of workout. So you got a strength focused one, hypertrophy sort of biased one, although there's some strength adaptations there. And maybe the third one is also hypertrophy focused. And then they're going to do some conditioning afterwards. That's kind of like a general sort of structure, but that's a very typical sort of training day that I would do. Now, if that particular person is like, I want to get as strong as possible over the next 4 weeks, like that's my main goal. So now maybe I'm shifting the rep ranges down a little bit. The average intensity is going to go up a little bit. But the movement selection is pretty similar. It's probably still full body if that's their preferred split. And yeah, that's kind of the framework for how I do this. I just, you know, there's definitely argument within the exercise science field, within the coaching world about, is concurrent better than conjugate? And when I say conjugate, people think West Side immediately, this like dynamic effort, you know, a lot of different accessory barbells and tools and such. Now, conjugate just means block training, right? So you'd have a block of hypertrophy work, a block of strength work, block of power work, block of endurance work. I'm doing it concurrently, all the stuff at the same time. And that's typically the strategy that I use.
Awesome. And within that concurrent training, how do you ensure that your clients will be progressively overloading since you don't have those particular blocks?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think actually people misunderstand progressive overload due to the word itself. What do you think overload? It kind of conjures up this idea that it has to be harder than what you can currently handle or more than what you have handled previously. And I don't know that that's wrong per se. It's just incomplete because when you look back at like the origins of progressive overload, like where this started, it was actually a physician training critically ill patients in the hospital and like getting them strong enough to leave the hospital and effectively live independently. And the idea was that once they could complete X amount of reps with a certain weight, that they could then increase the weight. Effectively, the fitness adaptation had shown up, making them demonstrably stronger. And so that in order to get the same sort of training stress, they had to increase the weight. So it's just like a chicken or egg sort of scenario. Does the exposure to a heavier than tolerable weight drive the adaptation? Or does it just need to be heavy enough? And then you get stronger. And then so you have to lift more weights. And I kind of favor that second sort of interpretation. You get bigger, faster, stronger, and then you're able to lift more weights or do them more quickly or lift them for more repetitions. Effectively, as you get fitter, you must maintain or match the sort of weights that you're lifting, the repetitions that you're completing, the training volume that you're completing to keep up with that new level of fitness. If you haven't got any fitter, well, you're not adding anything until those adaptations show up. And so within the context of a concurrent program, most of the variables are static, meaning that the reps are static. So we're doing fours, for example, for a series of weeks. The RPE is also static. So set of four reps at RP7, RP8, or even the percentage could, if you're using those instead of RPEs. Once the person gets stronger though, then the weight on the bar goes up. If they got weaker, the weight on the bar has to go down. And that, you know, the strength sort of adaptation is not a linear thing. Like, it just keeps going up in perpetuity on a very predictable rate. It kind of, the way I like to view it is it oscillates. Strength performance oscillates between a sort of ceiling and a floor, and within the middle is your average. And we want your average strength to go up over time, but some days you got it and some days you don't. So you need to adjust variables within a training session in order to match your current level of fitness. And I think as long as you're doing that over long periods of time, that does represent progressive overload. But the term I like to use so that people don't misinterpret it due to a kind of an incomplete understanding is progressive loading. You got to load the thing progressively, but it's not really overload. It's just sort of matching your current level of fitness. And so if somebody's getting fitter, weight on the bar is going up, repetitions are going up. You could say rest periods are going down, although all of these things are going to select for slightly different adaptations. But that's sort of the gist behind progressive loading, in my opinion.
I think that's really great, and a really great and different perspective, perhaps, because oftentimes clients in the initial phases, when they come to me and they're like, oh, well, I wasn't able to increase my weight on this and that for a few weeks. I'm like, well, that's okay. Is that fine? You know, you don't need to increase reps or weights on everything every single week. Otherwise, people would be insanely strong.
Oh my gosh. Do you know how many 1,000-pound squatters there would be out there? Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, It when you go into the literature, you know, this is what I do when I have questions, right? I'm like, well, has anybody studied this directly under a controlled sort of setting, just to get a sense of maybe what my expectation should be or to refine my thinking process? So I'm like, has anybody tried to figure out how quickly on average do people gain strength? Meaning that they have tested their 1RMs, you know, repeatedly throughout a training sort of intervention, or they assess them serially, like every few weeks. So do we know? Do people on average get stronger every week, every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks? What's the inter-individual range of variation? And so anyway, there's been one study that I know of that actually has looked at this. They compiled all of the clinical trials that have assessed strength change serially within a training intervention. And the average length between, hey, we tested your 1RM or some sort of analogous test, and actual demonstrable improvement in strength is about 3 to 4 weeks. And so when people are like, I couldn't add weight, you know, from last week, is this training program, does it suck? And it's like, well, it might not be great for you. That is one possibility. Certainly it might not be enough stress. It might be too much stress. It might be the wrong kind of stress for you, the individual, or we might not have given it enough time to work yet. And how you interpret the sort of result changes how you manage the person. If you think it's not enough stress, just based on 1 week's worth of data, you would increase the number of sets that they do or the number of reps that they do or something like that. If you think that it's too much stress, you would have them do less. And if you thought that it wasn't enough time, you would do nothing. You would just say, hey, let's stick with the plan. Be conservative on your loading. Don't overshoot the targets. And then we'll see what happens, you know, after next week. And that's pretty much how I favor things until about 3 to 4 weeks have gone by and somebody's still stagnant. At that point, I'm like, we should have seen some signs of life here with the training program. But before that, I'm like, man, it's really too soon to tell unless somebody is saying things like, I hate these movements. I hate these rep range. I really don't prefer it. And at that point, I'm like, well, this is just more of a preference thing. I don't know that the program is necessarily bad for you outside of your personal preferences, which is fine too. If you hate what you're doing, I don't think you're going to do it for very long. So I want to address that first and foremost.
Yeah, adherence, personal preference plays a huge role. That's for sure. But yeah, thank you for kind of laying it out that way. And Jordan, I want to go back to sort of the beginning where we talked about your travels. So you travel a lot. And so do you have any tips or strategies? How do you stay active throughout that time? How do you stay well nourished and well slept, which is often some of the hardest parts?
Yeah, no, the sleeping thing, I won't pretend to be an expert on that. I am a notoriously poor sleeper. I don't have the keys to the castle on that, unfortunately. I do find that maintaining some sort of, I just lump it into sleep hygiene to be helpful, meaning that I try to maintain a similar time to bed and similar time out of bed to the extent that's within my control, just to sort of keep my circadian rhythm at least some semblance of normalcy. Sleeping in a dark room, distraction free, no phone, in bed, things of that nature. But I can't tell people how successful that is because I don't sleep that well, but reasonable, unless you're changing a bunch of time zones, in which case you're going to have to establish a new circadian rhythm, in which case trying to go to bed at a similar time, within 30 minutes of the same time each day, and then trying to get out of bed at the same time, that's pretty much, that's pretty useful. For exercise, what I do is I look ahead wherever I'm going and I try to reach out to a gym owner on Instagram or via email saying, hey, I'm going to be in the area. Is it okay if I drop in? What are your, I'm just trying to get the scheduling thing out of the way, because a lot of the gyms that I have to train at, it's going to be like a CrossFit gym, for example. And I don't necessarily want to take a class. I prefer an open gym. So there are not a lot of, you know, powerlifting or strength focused gyms all over the world, but there are CrossFit gyms. And so connecting with people in the space saying, hey, I'd really love to train. Is there any time I can come in for open gym? And doing that ahead of time really not only saves a hassle, but also sets your expectations like, okay, I could probably train three days this week. Here are the days I'm training, kind of set that time aside. I prefer that. And that's what I do for training. Obviously people walk usually when they're traveling. So I don't tend to get too crazy on doing a bunch of extra conditioning. I really just want to get the lifting portion focused, that stuff done when I'm traveling. And then for food, honestly, if I'm giving people advice on what to eat when they're traveling, I actually tend to favor a more liberal view of this, like do whatever you want. Because it's just such a finite period of time you're traveling, you want to enjoy it. We there's a lot of awesome things that happen over breaking bread together. And I just find this like over restriction when people travel. I'm like, man, we only get one life here. So what's the point? If you travel, you know, 30 weeks out of the year and it's more of like for your job, that's a different thing altogether. But for vacation, I don't know that it makes sense to restrict that much for folks. You know, I'm a big fan of the Pareto rule, the 80-20 rule. And if what you're doing at home for the most part is a health promoting dietary pattern, and then you're traveling for a week, like, I don't know, man, go crazy. If you do find that when you travel, I'll say this, and you feel like you're overeating regularly, you're indulging, maybe you even would call it binging on some level. To me, that's almost a red flag. Maybe we'll call it a pink flag for that things are maybe overly restrictive at home. And so once you're kind of freed from that, then you just go crazy. To me, that is a form of maybe some sort of disordered eating. We don't need to pathologize people's eating habits if they don't really have something going on there. But I do start to worry when people get away from home and they just go crazy with it. But for me, I don't tend to put too many restrictions on myself. I do try to get an Airbnb if I'm traveling so I can cook at least some of the meals, because man, if you have to eat out for multiple meals out of the day, the problem is that the portion sizes are too big. The ingredients list is usually more than what you would normally use. And it's really tough to maintain energy balance when you're doing that for every single meal of the day. So I find that when people travel, they tend to overconsume fat, underconsume protein. And so maybe trying to hedge your bets, if you do have to eat all of your meals out, that you're getting a lean protein, you're trying to do stuff with sauce on the side. I guess that's all fine. But I just try to prepare as many meals as I can within where I'm staying. So that way, when I do go out, I just don't have to think about it. I'll have what I want. And for me and my genetic makeup and my activity levels, that works fine. I should say there's going to be a wide range of inter-individual variability. Some people will be unable to do that and maintain weight, and that's okay too. If you gain a little bit of weight when you're traveling, fine. If you lose a little bit of weight when you travel, fine. This is not like a moral sort of view on you as a person. It just is kind of how you respond to a changing environment, and that's fine too. But the 80-20 rule, I think, is reasonable overall.
Yeah, I think that's a really good base in general. And I like that you mentioned the time restraint. So I've been a digital nomad for like 5.5 years. So I do travel a lot. And oftentimes people are like, oh, are you still tracking when you're traveling? I'm like, well, if I wouldn't be, I wouldn't be aware of my nutrition half of my life or half of the time. But if you go on vacation once every 2 years, by all means, you know, and enjoy that.
don't
go on a diet throughout that time and expect to be losing weight throughout that time. But enjoy in moderation, practice in moderation.
Yeah. I've had clients that are like on their honeymoon. They're like, well, what should I do for my diet while I'm on my honeymoon? And I'm like, don't think about it. I mean, I'm serious, and I don't mean that as a dismissive like thing as a coach, but it's like my goal, if I'm coaching somebody, working with somebody on weight management, for example, is for them to have freedom. It's the same thing with movement. I want people to have unrestricted movement, you know, do whatever you want to do, and we can kind of program things based on your preferences. Well, nutritionally, I want people to be able to sort of figure out a way to have a dietary pattern that works for their goals, fulfills their needs in multiple different types of environments, whether that's in a foreign country, whether it's while they're traveling, whether it's at home. And so if they don't have that sort of flexibility, then I almost feel like I've either failed as a coach, or we haven't had enough time together to sort of really establish all these habits. But yeah, giving people some leeway, I think, is generally good, especially if people are on vacation. But if it's your life, if your life is travel, you're probably going to have some more constraints in place, because it is certainly challenging to not be able to prepare meals at home all the time, to not be able to get fresh ingredients, to transport food on the regular basis. That certainly raises some issues, which we see in the general public. 30 years ago, most people ate maybe a quarter of the meals that they consumed, and they were prepared away from the home. And now it's close to 60% of all meals that people eat are prepared outside of the home. And it's like, yeah, which goes, the average calorie intake has gone up, the average sugar intake has gone up, fiber intake has gone down, things of that nature. And it's like, well, these are predictable based on the modern food environment. Again, no fault of anyone per se. Like, I don't want to point blame at folks, but if you do have particular weight management goals, it's sort of your responsibility to find a suitable solution. And that suitable solution may be entirely behaviorally based, right? We can come up with certain behaviors, certain strategies. People may need an extra hand, whether it's respect to medication, for example. A lot of different options here, but I think removing that sort of moral kind of hang up that people have, like, oh, I'm bad, or I'm a failure, or this food is bad. I don't really love that. Let's just try to figure out what sort of strategies, what sort of interventions do you need to kind of live the life that you want to live. So
really good take home message. And just one last thing I was going to say on in regards to the sleep, and also because I know you're obviously performing cognitively in your in all that you do when you travel. I was speaking to a researcher that specializes in creatine just the other day, and it was, you're possibly familiar with this, but he said to me that when he changes time zones and he knows he wants to be sharp the next days or day, he actually doubles his dose in creatine. So instead of aiming for, say, 5 to 10 grams, he would say 10 to 20, and that they have seen very beneficial outcomes for that. For me, that was new. I don't know if that's something that you've been familiar with, but yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I could foresee that people who do derive some benefit, whether it's cognitively, and that you'd have to define that based on, what are your outcome measures, right? There are some people who tend to favor the sort of non-responder to creatine, that sort of phenotype, if they dose every other day or a few times a week compared to every day. And certainly at some lower doses, you kind of do increase your risk gradually of being a non-responder. And so perhaps when people are traveling, if they do up the dose, maybe there's a cumulatively, they're getting a higher dose of creatine and they're not missing doses. That all seems plausible. I just am not familiar enough with the evidence on, like, cognitive performance whilst traveling with a higher dose of creatine. Seems plausible, but overall, I think I'm a little, I think I'm skeptical on on the benefits of creatine from cognitive performance or outcomes that we care about, whether it's like vigilance, attention, memory, executive function, or whatever. I know that there is a lot of research out there, and my general idea about this is that it's still in its infancy and we need to get better data. Like, I feel very comfortable in saying creatine increases muscular power, muscular force production, increases lean mass that people tend to gain from resistance training. Definitely know it's been used in clinical trials for everything from heart attacks, so myocardial infarction. Like, there's been some evidence about certain research centers infusing people with creatine IV, cerebral palsy, sure, certain other pregnancy-related conditions. But I don't, we're going to need more data. And so that's interesting to me. I'll have to think about that a little further.
Well, I think it only speaks to you as a researcher or as someone in the evidence space, coaching practice, because we want to gain a good amount of evidence before we make up our minds. But yeah, Jordan, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate you coming on the show to speak with us. And I will, of course, drop all your handles and Barbell Medicine website, et cetera, in the show notes. So truly, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jordan. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And one more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening. And don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.